You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. And in that regard, there are two publishing houses that translate Steiner into English for us and also give me permission to do these recordings. And they are SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London. Please consider patronizing those organizations directly if you're purchasing books and the like. They help us do this immensely. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Reimagining Academic Studies. It is 7 lectures, Collected Works, Volume 81, translated by Judith Wormuth Atkinson. This is Lecture 3. Entitled Anthroposophy and Philosophy, given in Berlin on March 7th, 1922. Most honored participants, it is always difficult when, having a serious scholarly conscience, one tries to translate what we have inherited in the concept of logos into one of the modern languages. When we want to translate logos, we usually say word, as the Bible does. However, when we have in mind logic, we do not think as much of word as of a thought, of the way thought functions in the human individual, and of its patterns. For philosophy, though, in quotes, logos means, for philology, though, logos, in quotes, means consciousness, in quotes. We develop scholarship that is based on the word. I mean that what we understand under logos today, according to modern language use, is the basis of all philosophy. And when we speak of philosophy, we can sense the reflection of an undefined experience of logos in everything that we do not define, but rather experience as philosophy. At the time when philosophy was established, the meaning of the word logos was undoubtedly something more than simply its literal meaning. It implied a particular inner experience of the human being. The word philosophy implies that the human had a certain interest, sophia, in everything that was related to logos. This was an interest that, if not personal, was certainly generally human. The understanding of the word philosophy was related more to the inner attitude of the human being toward the wisdom-filled content of science than to the possession of scientific knowledge itself. Our sense of philosophy is not as certain today as it was at the time when the concept of philosophy overlapped with the desire for scientific knowledge. Parenthesis, I would not say it overlapped with science itself. Close parenthesis. The word pointed at the same time to an inner human attitude. As a consequence, our inner feeling when we speak of or deal with philosophy now is extremely unclear. If we try to determine it externally or simply in a dialectical way, it is also very difficult to bring this unclear feeling out of the depth of our consciousness. Our present time requires, rather, that we try to explore the human experience of philosophy in the course of our historical development. Precisely this latter kind of understanding is required. If as Central Europeans we look back a few decades, we will see that specifically in Central Europe, the experience of those who wished to enter into the spirit of philosophy was different from our experience now in the second decade of the 20th century. Today we have experienced so much more compared with what people experienced in earlier times through the course of many centuries. We may say that we have more experience, not only in a physical sense, but also in a spiritual sense. And if we look back at the experiences that a student of philosophy could have had as a Central European during the 50s, 60s, and 70s of the 19th century, or even later, we will find basically that they were mainly the following. Scholars looked back at the peak of the development of German philosophy at the great time of the philosophers Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel. Then scholars looked at the world around them, which consisted of educated and knowledgeable people, who regarded that era of philosophy as something outdated, and who believed that the rising scientific views should replace the earlier philosophical observations. While they admired the greatness of the sublime thought that could be seen in someone like Schelling, and were fascinated by the energy and power of Fichte's intellectual development, and had, perhaps, some sense of Hegel's far-reaching creative thinking, people saw this era of classical German philosophy as something science had already surpassed. At the same time, there was a desire to develop something based on natural science that would become a worldview. We can find this desire everywhere, from the aspirations of the scientists concerning, quote, force and matter, close quote, to those thinkers who were more careful in trying to achieve a philosophical worldview based on natural science, but who also rejected the former idealistic philosophy. Thus, in this area, there were all sorts of nuances in thinking, as well as in research. There was also a third type of thinker. They were not able to go along with explanations of a worldview based simply on natural science. Neither could they go as deeply into the reality of thought as Hegel did. These thinkers were confronted with the big question: how could people relate the objective outside world to their thinking, which was formed as something that existed only within themselves? So the specialists in the theory of knowledge unanimously called for, quote, turning back to Kant, close quote, though each found a very different way back to Kant. These were intelligent thinkers like Liebmann, Foucault, and so forth, who remained, however, mainly in the thought frame of theory of knowledge. They did not find an answer to the question of how human thought could bridge over to an external, trans-subjective reality using images of their own internal thinking. The situation that I am describing to you here, the one in which the students of philosophy found themselves in the last third of the 19th century, did not bring any resolution. In a sense, it was as if they were in the middle of a drama or in the middle of a piece of art that was developing in time, a piece of art to which no one had found an end yet. The scholarly aspirations were running into the indefinite. They were ending with a large number of questions, but the courage, even merely to attempt to resolve those questions, was missing everywhere. The reality now is that the situation in the entire world of philosophy appears to be very different from the situation in the last third of the 19th century, which I just described. Now we face philosophical views that have a completely different foundation, and they force us to characterize the current philosophical situation in a completely different way. If we would like to characterize the situation in philosophy today, with the eyes of our soul, we would see clearly something for which our vision was sharpened in the first two decades of the 20th century, namely the extremely different philosophical views of Western, of Central, and of Eastern Europe. Today, our inward experience of philosophy is different from the one even of the recent past. It is an experience to which we can associate three names: Herbert Spencer, Hegel, and Vladimir Soloviev. These three personalities are the representatives of everything that characterizes the situation in philosophy today. Inwardly, this has always been the case, or at least it has been the case for a very long time. But only today we can see this situation so clearly before us. Let us look at the West. Herbert Spencer. If I want to be precise, I should describe the details of the entire development of this philosophical view, how it led from Bacon and Locke through Mill to Spencer. This tracing of history, however, is not my task today. In Herbert Spencer, we see someone who wanted to justify philosophy, but he wanted to justify philosophy using only systems of concepts established in natural science. Spencer unconditionally says yes to natural science and draws conclusions only on the basis of his own affirmation that philosophical thinking about the world must be founded in natural science. We can see that Spencer is trying to grasp certain concepts of natural science, such as the concept that describes how matter constantly shrinks and expands, and the concepts of differentiation and consolidation. For example, he observes certain processes in the plant that expands in its leaves and shrinks the seed into its germ. He tries to define such concepts in clear scientific terms to establish a worldview in this way. He even tries to think of human society, of the social organism, in a way that would present an analogy to the biological organism. This, however, immediately creates a problem. The biological organism of the human being is dependent on the combination of everything that helps this organism to relate to the external world, for example, through perception, through imagination, and so forth. Each individual organism is dependent on the particular developments influenced by the sensory system. Herbert Spencer does not find a similar sensory system in the social organism. No central coordinating nervous system is to be found there. Nevertheless, built entirely on the foundation of natural science, he produces such a social organism, and in a way sees it as the crowning element of his philosophical construct. What does this actually mean in the Western world? It means that in the West, scientific thinking has developed in its fullest, in its legitimate one-sidedness. It means a fine ability of observation and a talent for experimentation have developed from the original dispositions of the different peoples. It means that there is definite interest in observing the external sensory reality down to the smallest detail without being impatient and wanting to rush to generalizations. It also means that there is a trend toward keeping science in the frame of the external sensory world of facts. It means that there is some fear, as I would call it, of expanding from the sensory world to a larger frame, to an all-embracing world. Since the human being, however, cannot help but live as well in a world that is beyond the sensory, where experience is given through more than just the senses, it appears that in the West, knowledge of the entire spiritual world must be completely yielded to the private belief of an individual, and that this belief must develop free of any scientific influence. People do not allow the content of religion to be affected by scientific research. Spencer, in his way, expands the scientific method of thinking to sociology, and then stops there. We see that in the West there is supposed to be a strict distinction between science, which is required to be based completely on natural science, and the human being, for whom spiritual content now has no connection to science. Let us now move forward from Herbert Spencer to the points we are confronted with in the case of Hegel. It does not matter that in the second third of the 19th century, Hegel, who belonged to the first third, was considered superseded by the philosophers of Central Europe, because Hegel represents in a most significant way the characteristics of Central Europe. Let us look at Hegel. Hegel's emotional disposition speaks of a certain aversion against the Western universalistic, scientific manner of dealing with a worldview, as in the case of Spencer. This worldview, however, was prepared by Hegel's predecessors, the naturalists, as well as the philosophers. We can see, for example, that Hegel could not stand Newton. He had no sympathy for the purely mechanical way Newton viewed the universe. Hegel rejected not only Newton's color theory, but also his entire interpretation of the cosmos. Hegel invested a great deal in returning to Kepler's laws of planetary motion He analyzed these laws and came to the conclusion that Newton did not add anything new to them, but that the entire law of gravity is presented already in Kepler's theory. Hegel adopted Kepler's theory because he saw that in Kepler's work it is more or less the spiritual experience which gives birth to scientific thinking that is comprehensive. Kepler was trying to explain the externally scientific on the basis of the spiritual. To Hegel, Kepler was simply the person who was able to penetrate the spirit with thinking, and to build a bridge between what was scientifically recognized and what, according to the Western world, could only be believed. Hegel saw Kepler as a person who was capable of elevating science to the level that, in the view of the West, was reserved only for faith. This is the reason why Hegel, like Goethe, rejected Newton's color theory. We see in Hegel's disposition a certain antipathy against everything that seems completely natural from the perspective of Newton's disposition. At the same time, Hegel had the real capacity to live exclusively within the realm of thought. What Goethe said to Schiller was absolutely self-evident to Hegel, that he, quote, sees his ideas with his eyes, close quote. This statement may seem to show some naivete, but sometimes, if we see it correctly, this kind of naivete turns out to be the most profound philosophical wisdom. Because Hegel's life was entirely within the realm of thought, he would have simply not understood how people can insist that the idea of a triangle cannot be comprehended. To him, a higher world of revelation, a world of higher spirituality, exists for us only because it is reflected in the shadows of a plane filled with thoughts. From above, the spiritual world throws its shadow images upon the plane of the human soul, where human thoughts develop. To Hegel, the concept of higher spirituality is based on the fact that the higher spiritual world is reflected in the human soul in the form of thoughts. Hegel tended to experience those thoughts as something spiritual. Therefore, he did not experience natural phenomena in their elementary presence either, but saw them in the thought images reflected on the plane of the human soul. In this way, it becomes impossible to separate knowledge from faith in Hegel's philosophy in the external manner described above, a manner that is absolutely natural for the Western world. It became Hegel's lifelong task to unite the sensory physical world with the spiritual world, which the West, because of its dispositions, wants to simply relegate to the area of faith. He wanted to combine the two worlds into one world that we can know about. In Hegel's case, knowledge was not opposed to faith. Here, however, the human soul is confronted with an important problem. How do we find the bridge between faith and knowledge, between nature and the spiritual, in our inner life? Hegel's tragedy was that he saw the problem, which he was able to set forth in such a grand manner, only in relation to the plane of thought. Although he was able to experience the inner power, the inner life of thinking, he did not perceive anything that was alive in its content. Let us look at the Hegelian logic. He wanted to go back to the old concept of logos. He felt that if we want to have any real concept of logos at all, then logos must be something that is not simply thought, but that actively penetrates the world and fills it with life. To him, logos is not simply an abstract logical content. To him, it becomes a real content of the world. However, if we consider Hegel's treatise, in quotes, Logic, one of the three parts of his philosophy, we will see that it contains only abstract concepts. Hence, those who are really enthusiastic about Hegel's philosophy are strongly affected by the profoundly correct sense that one can comprehend the principle of creation in the world through the understanding of Logos. Logos must be, quote, God before the creation of the world, close quote, to put it in Hegel's own words. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, the question is how Hegel developed this concept of Logos. He began with being, then came to nothingness, to becoming, and to existence. He came to causality, to the purpose, to teleology. We look at the concepts of Hegel's logic and we ask if this could have been the content of the divine before the beginning of creation. It is abstract logic, furthering creativity. Logos as a postulate, but a postulate of purely human thought. One can almost feel the tragedy in this. One can also feel the tragedy in the fact that Hegel's philosophy counts as being overcome. However, it contains elements that can give birth to something new. It contains seeds. Hegel saw in this philosophy his salvation, being, nothingness, becoming, existence. But today, when people learn about Hegel, they say this is outdated. We do not have to deal with it. However, if we decide to experience this concept in a more internal way, through a process of the soul, in the way Hegel wanted to experience it, then all concepts of empiricism and rationalism disappear. And the thought can be experienced, and the experience can be directly thought. Then the thought becomes experience, and the experience pure thought. Those who are willing to do this feel the desire to free thinking from abstraction. They see Hegel's logic as the key to a transformation of thought that could turn into something very different if it could express itself more directly. Hegel's thought appears to me as the seed of a plant that does not show what it will become, although it contains a multitude of possibilities. It seems to me that when this seed grows, when the human being grows it with care and plants it in spiritual soil, using anthroposophic research, then the seed will show precisely that thought not only exists in thinking, but also can be experienced as reality. Here we see that Hegel was a Central European. Moving to the East, we see in Vladimir Soloviev a man whose vocation, unlike any other philosophers, is to become more and more part of our philosophical search. We see someone who becomes gradually more important as we let his unique ideas influence us. At the same time, we see in Soloviev a representative of an Eastern European way of thinking, which, however, is not the Asian or the Oriental way. Soloviev has adopted everything that is European, but has developed it further in a particularly Eastern variant. What do we see in his philosophy with regard to the human desire for scientific knowledge? We see that Soloviev disdains the kind of thinking that the West appreciates most, particularly in the case of Herbert Spencer. To Soloviev, this kind of thinking really points to the truth and the knowledge he is looking for. In contrast, Soloviev offers a real experience in the realm of the spiritual. In his philosophy, this experience is not accompanied by full consciousness, but appears rather in the unconscious as atavism, albeit in the spiritual realm. It is more or less the attempt to experience knowingly, but almost as if in a dream, what the West shifts, also consciously, to the realm of faith. Thus, in the East, we are confronted with things that could be experienced in an undefined way, something that appears as another form of experiencing Hegel's idea of building a bridge between natural existence and the realm of the spiritual. At first, those with a Central European spiritual background feel uncomfortable exploring Soloviev's philosophy on a deeper level. He recommends something that reminds them of a foggy mysticism, of an excessive life of the human soul, of something that cannot be formulated in terms of the external world, but can be experienced only internally. Those people feel the completely undefined character of the mystical experience. They also find that Soloviev uses the same concepts and expressions as Hegel, Hume, Mill, even some that recall Spencer, but he uses them only as illustrations. Therefore, we can say that Soloviev certainly does not get stuck in the foggy mysticism. Rather, the way he treats religion as science, looks for it everywhere, and develops it as philosophy, allows us to compare and analyze his teachings in terms of Western concepts. Currently, we are confronted with the following situation. In the West, we see the effort to develop a worldview based on natural science. That is, the effort to place natural science on one side and the spiritual on the other. We struggle with the problem of finding a bridge between the two sides with the help of Hegel's unclear phrases, such as, quote, nature is spirit in its otherness, close quote, or, quote, spirit is the concept when it has returned to itself, close quote. In these confusing phrases, we see Hegel's tragedy of being able to experience everything he was searching for, but only by entertaining abstract thoughts. In the East, however, we see how Soloviev has preserved the way in which the Church Fathers must have discussed philosophy before the Council of Nicaea. He completely transports us back to the first 3 centuries after Christ in the Western world. Thus, in the East, we can see an experience of the spiritual world that is not yet capable of elevating itself to its own conceptual definitions. It needs Western concepts to express itself, even though in its system these concepts remain unclear, imposed, and alien. We can see how the philosophical understanding of the world has developed in 3 different ways. Looking at this threefold way in which the philosophical understanding of the world is developed, out of the very character and predispositions of the West, the East, and Central Europe, we realize that now, when science is extending its influence uniformly in every area of human society, it is our task to find something else that goes beyond these 3 philosophical streams. The 3 streams are based generally on elements that formerly made philosophy a personal, human affair. Today we see that the West, Middle Europe, and the East follow their love of wisdom in different ways. We understand that in ancient times, philosophy could have been still an inner condition of the soul. In our times, however, when people are so individualized, the love of wisdom is manifested in many different ways. Perhaps this is precisely the reason for us to realize what our own task is, and particularly what the task is of those who are in the middle, between East and West, where the problem appears in its most tragic and most intense form, even if today it does not yet concern all philosophical souls equally. If I had to present this issue visually, I would say the following. From a philosophical point of view, the voice of Soloviev is like that of the old priest who lives in the higher worlds and has to develop certain abilities in order to live in those higher worlds. In Soloviev's work, we hear everywhere the language of the priest transformed into philosophy. In the West, the voice of Herbert Spencer is like that of a man of the world who wants to adjust to the practicalities of life. He wants to give science a structure that can produce a practical foundation of life, as Darwin does with his theory. In the middle, we have neither the secular man nor the priest. Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel are not priests like Soloviev. In the middle, we have the teacher, the pedagogue of the people. He is there even where German philosophy is based on religious contemplation. There, the minister has become a teacher. Even Hegel's philosophy has the character of teaching. In modern days, for example, in Oswald Kulpa, we see how we have lost philosophy, which now is nothing but a summary of the ideas presented in the individual sciences. When it comes to non-organic science, we ask ourselves what sort of concepts it brings forth. When it comes to organic science, we ask ourselves the same question. What sort of concepts does it bring forth? The same applies to history, religion, and so forth. We collect those concepts and construct with them, completely superficially, an abstract unity. What I am trying to say is that the subject of the theory in the different sciences should be one common theory. Considering the sensitivity of the people, this is generally the point that science in Central Europe should reach. If, however, we reflect, we see that because we are influenced by thinking like that of Herbert Spencer, we are obligated to stick to unconditional belief in natural science, to the belief in our ability to experience through observation, experiment, and our reflecting reason, even belief in reason that can elevate itself above observation and experiment. However, we deceive ourselves. If we think that there is no problem in transferring the concepts we have gained in such a manner to the higher level of the social organism. In trying to comprehend the social organism with the help of the same concepts we have derived from natural existence, we overlook the fact that the social organism does not have the most important characteristic of the natural organism, the sensorium. We see that the strong leaning toward natural science forces people, such as Newton, to hold on to only the mechanical and to try to satisfy their spiritual needs outside the realm of science. As we know, Newton tried to explain the apocalypse, but from the perspective of mysticism. Hence, along with his scientifically established worldview, he was searching for something mystical as well. Let us look at natural science as it appeared in the 19th century, and as it was gradually adopted by Central Europe. Here, science was established according to the model of Western scientific thinking. Without our noticing, the entire worldview developed on the basis of the Western model. People went mad when someone once tried to defend Goethe's ideas of physics as contrasted with those of Newton. What about the development of biology? Goethe established a kind of organic science that required the experience of concepts by means of mathematical thinking. Our time urgently presses for us to develop a science of biology that suits modern thought better than the one we have inherited from previous times. In its further progress during the 19th century, however, Central Europe did not accept Goethe's biology, but that of Darwin, a science full of concepts that relate to those of Goethe as the concepts of the 16th century to those of the 18th. Concepts kept developing only in Central Europe. The West was satisfied with concepts that were sufficient only for the understanding of nature. This is why certain concepts simply do not exist in the West, and why they disappeared when Central Europe adopted Western thought. For example, Central Europe lacks the idea of the living thought, as we see it in Hegel. The concept of comprehending reality separately from the empirical. This idea was lost, because the way of thinking in Central Europe was flooded with Western thought. Therefore, here in Central Europe, we have the task to observe exactly what a naturalistic way of thinking really is. People dislike the anthroposophist who is attracted to this naturalistic way of thinking, as much as they dislike the naturalist. I would never say anything against the way of thinking in natural science. Anybody who believes I would is mistaken. However, I must see the kind of thought in natural science in its pure form, and then I must try to characterize it in its pure form. If we confront natural science without prejudice, and if we accept the conclusions of Western studies without imposing any philosophical interpretations, what science or Western scholars describe, such as what is described so ingeniously by Haeckel, would appear everywhere not as solutions, not as answers, but only as questions. To the unbiased thinker, all of natural science becomes gradually a great universal question, rather than an answer to our questions. In everything, one can feel how the best scholarship on natural science, including the atomic theory, which I do not reject but want only to place correctly, turns into one big question, which speaks to us with the voice of the West. What are the origins of this question? We will not discover the complete reality if we look only at the external world and focus simply on the perception of the empirical. We are born into the world as human beings and cannot change the way we are designed. We take into our inner self a part of reality to build our views based on it. Then we turn to the external world, to the sensory empirical, and we fail to integrate into our views that part of reality that lives in ourselves. Only through human struggling can we connect the inner half of reality to the part that looks back at us from the outside world. In the West, we see one half of reality, studied with particular dedication. That half, however, produces only questions, because it is not complete. On one side, we see ourselves confronted with one half of reality, the empirical, and we look carefully, and if we look carefully, it leads us to a question. Central Europe realized the character of questioning in Western thought and tried to get through to thought itself. This is what the philosophy of Hegel did. The East grasped what is beyond thought and what affects thought, but it was not able to fully awaken it and to give its body skeletal structure. In his philosophy, Soloviev was able to develop flesh, muscles, and even blood, but it lacked a skeleton. Therefore, he adopted concepts from Hegel, Hume, and others, and gave a foreign skeleton to what he himself had created. What we experience in our spirit can be transformed only when we no longer need a foreign support system. Soloviev's spiritual experience, however, exists like a shadow, because it cannot produce its own skeletal structure, and thus cannot become apparent. If we are not satisfied with only an external skeletal system, but want to live in spirituality and to develop through hard spiritual work, then we should build a skeletal structure for our spiritual experience and develop the concepts for it. The exercises I mention in my study, Knowledge of Higher Worlds, Initiation, published in title An Outline of Esoteric Science, and others, would be appropriate for that purpose. They can help you develop an inner organism of conceptions. This would be the other side of reality, the side that germinates in the Eastern philosophy of Soloviev. Central Europe has always had the challenge of building a bridge between nature and spirit. We have to deal with another important historical problem as well, how to build a bridge between the West and the East. This is the task we have in contemporary philosophy, and it leads inevitably to anthroposophy. If anthroposophy is able to give substance to its own experience of thought, then it can also allow for experiencing natural reality in a fully materialistic way, as it is experienced in the West. In that case, the bridge between pure faith and knowledge, between cognition and subjective certainty, would be built with fully engaged scientific effort and not with abstract concepts. Then philosophy will develop into real anthroposophy, and science would be able to stimulate philosophy at any time. Hegel's philosophy could be brought back to life only if it is rejuvenated by the bloodstream of spirituality introduced through anthroposophy. Then its logic will not be too abstract to be, quote, the spirit beyond nature, close quote, as Hegel wanted it to be. Rather, it will replace the abstract with the living spirit of philosophy. All this gave anthroposophy the primary task to explore the following. How can we build a bridge between what we now call truth, which must include the full reality, and what we call science, which also must include the full reality, in accordance with our modern standpoint now, many years after the time of Hegel. Briefly, this problem had to be articulated, and it is the most important philosophical problem of anthroposophy. Quote, what is the relationship between truth and reality? Close quote. In my introduction later today, I would like to place this problem at the top of my list with the observations that will follow next. The end of Lecture 3.